Hey, what up? This is Swamp Fiends, episode 13. How are you doing, Jimmy?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
As best as I can be doing with, all this fucking COVID shit. But I thought we should let the listeners know something and try and get ahead of it before it becomes like a big issue. And that's, we haven't been honest about this podcast. It's been a little bit of a ruse, and I regret to inform all the listeners that this whole podcast has been one big social networking operation just to try and recruit people for our eventual Ashes of Creation Guild.
Yes.
So I'm sorry to – I regret to inform everyone that all of this shit is fake, and we're just trying to recruit people to like – farm our node and like, you know,
I've actually never played Malifaux.
Yeah, you don't even know what you're just fucking ad-libbing. You just have some skill in improv. The whole point behind this is so we can get like a scientific node with some dwarves or something. What are you thinking? What race are we running?
I don't know. I just want to be president.
No, dude, I'm mayor for sure. That's the whole point. We're going to run a scientific node. I'm going to be mayor. I'm going to fly him out. I'm going to flex on all the fools. That's the whole point of the pod. I guess we could talk about Malifaux or some shit. It's hard to do that. So I guess like for real though, like one thing that it's good to know is the reason that we've been sort of spacing these out is because like it's very hard to, well, talking about Malifaux is fun, especially when we can't play it. But I feel like we're just going to get burnt out on either the game or potting about it. If we keep potting like every week, eventually we're going to get to a point where you've played less games than you've done podcasts. And that just seems like a really bad,
I think we're almost there,
recipe. Yeah. I mean, you've probably played like 30 games close. Or something.
Not even, maybe 20,
not even 30,
maybe 50.
No, it has to be like 30.
No, impossible.
It's how many games have we played? You started in January, and then like February 8th is when we had to quit. I mean, I don't know. I might have to start getting on Vassal though, because
I think we've played 10 games, and then I've played.
We've played way more than 10. We've played 4 in that little break we had between when we were able to see each other mid-pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe 5. And then we played a bunch before that. I think
you're 20.
Probably like 30. I don't know. Anyway, but so if you see the pace of this pod slowing down, it's not for any lack of eagerness. It's more just like we're going to pace ourselves and not burn ourselves out. And only have so many ideas in the brain. And it's hard to like talk about something without, you know, inspiration. Without a muse in front of you. That being said, today we want to talk about how like gaming biases can emerge based off the games you play and how that can sort of mess with you in the dojo. I guess broadly, I want to talk about cognitive biases within Malifaux and gaming in general, I guess. But I see this sort of the spiritual successor to that episode we did on like the dojo discrepancy, where we talked about how your ideas before the game can, you know, eventually screw you because you didn't realize how it was going to play out on the table and it came out so differently. I think the opposite is also true, that your experience on the table can sort of screw you over in the dojo, where you get some like really, you kind of stuck in your ways and thinking about certain things, and that can ultimately corner you in a position where you're not thinking about things in the most objective way. This is also why this is like one of the main reasons I think it's good for us to exist within the Malifaux casting space, where you are someone who hasn't had as much experience as probably the other podcasters who are doing it, because I do think that the more you play this game, the more you can get stuck in some of these little traps. And it is just like, I think it's so refreshing to have someone who's approaching the game new. I think it's always good when you have like a good player who's coming into your faction new and to see what they see and why they see it differently. I think the same could be said as someone like yourself who's good at gaming and can come into Malifaux and be like, well, what about this? Why is no one doing this? And let's go ahead and start off. So I think the, I don't want to go through, like, if you go Google, you know, cognitive biases, I don't want to go through the whole list of those, you know, like, obviously there's some gambler's fallacy when you're playing like any sort of game with a variance mechanic. There's all of these sort of like things that you can do that are, I don't know, you could say someone fell for the classic trap of doing this sort of fallacy, some debate lord shit, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't really want to talk about those. I want to sort of skip that step and only talk about the ones that I think have a direct allegory to Malifaux itself and the things that I have found myself doing. Especially is like what I'm going to talk about. So I think the first two that come to mind, and they're hand in hand with each other, are these two biases are sort of the recency and primacy bias. So recency means you base your sort of idea off of the most recent sort of set of events, and then you might have some cognitive biases associated with that. Primacy is your basing your outlook on the first set of results. And I think recency bias is like especially very salient in Malifaux. If you go to listen to any podcast, including ours, you'll catch a snippet of something when they're on like the third point about something. So like if you listen to any Third Floor Wars deep dive, tabletop talk, they'll be like, obvious point, oh, I didn't think about this. And then, wait, what? Because I think even experienced players find themselves in a position where they're like, okay, this is good. And then I have recently developed some sort of idea about something based off of a weird sort of corner case scenario that happened on the table. Mm-hmm. So I would even say like an example of that for myself is I did the deep dive with Tara. And we're talking about all the obvious Terra shit. And then at some point I say that like Turf War is my favorite strat in that pool. And at that point, I think it was kind of true because Corrupted Idols hadn't been buffed to be Terra's obvious best strat. But that was also because I had recently got out of a game where I played in a Corrupted Idols and my opponent put all the idols underneath their like people that I couldn't kill and just stood on top of it. So even though Corrupted Idols in its whole like sort of GG zero run was a good Terra strat, if not one of her best, the most recent event was coloring my vision more than any other thing.
Yeah. I can't remember in Magic. I can't remember the exact What exactly was it for anyone that plays Magic? It was something where I was playing. I played a matchup, and the last time I played it, someone did a certain strategy, like a sideboarding strategy, that was like it like blew me away. And then I ended up later down the road, I ended up switching to their deck, and I played the same matchup, and I was like, oh, I saw this guy do this, I'm gonna try to do this, and I guess it didn't work well at all. It was kind of like, instead of like, I don't know, I thought it was like a good play, but it was just a bad play that I fell for. So because I saw it work, like, which I guess can happen in Malifaux if someone does some trick again, like does something against you where they kind of like bait you into overcommitting or something and you fall for it. And then if you try it against someone else and they're, you know, they don't fall for it, it's kind of like...
Yeah, it doesn't mean that it's like a mathematically good move, right? It's just the last thing that sort of got you.
You remember, yeah.
That happens all the time. That's especially relevant with like schemes because
exactly. I feel like a certain scheme.
If someone scores something, someone scores something that you weren't expecting, in your next like five games, you're going to think that the opponent is bringing that thing, right?
That, or you think they found something like, you know, genius, and you try to like do it yourself, and then you realize it was just, you just didn't catch it, but it's not like anything. Maybe it's, you know, not as good as you thought it was just because it got you.
Exactly. Like the first time that, what's that scheme that no one is ever going to take in the new packet?
Which one?
Yeah. Well, I guess let's be a little less extreme. The one I'm thinking about is the three marker one. I can't remember. Let's say Let Them Bleed. Like, I think Let Them Bleed is kind of weak. But the first time someone gets Let Them Bleed on me, I'm going to be like spending the next five games thinking that they got Let Them Bleed.
That, yeah. or you can find a way to pull it off.
Yeah.
Think you can pull it off.
Are you spending a bunch of AP healing your model because you're like, oh, I got to deny Let Them Bleed.
Exactly. Yeah.
I got to keep this guy topped off, when in reality, like, very few people are going to take that unless they have like a very specific reason for doing so. And that's going to like color your opinion for a few matches. I also think the jokers really contribute to this, because you can have crazy activations from any model in your crew. And that sort of makes you overvalue some things that maybe don't consistently put up numbers. Just because your four-stone minion has like a, you know, like it has a five damage severe or something, but it's like crappy otherwise, it doesn't mean it's good just because you can flip red sometimes, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the game when I played Reva and the shield bears, I think I red jokered twice on them.
Yeah.
Like, I think they're good, but I try not to let that, you know, I take that out of the equation when evaluating them.
That's a perfect example, because you red jokered twice on damage. Well, you did once off on attack and then once on damage, like the next turn. And for the next 5 days, we're both like, oh man, check out this public enemies list with like three shield bears. Oh, that shit's unbeatable. Like,
so I still think they're good.
Yeah. I think they're pretty good too.
They hit for six, heal one, hard to kill.
Yeah. So I think recency bias is another thing that's we're talking about while we're on this sort of bit of a topic. That's just sort of the opposite. So your first experience with something primacy bias, colors your opinion throughout. And that's especially salient when you're trying something out for the first time and it just doesn't go, you know, the way you expected.
Yep.
It can also,
the cop is broken, Pandora's trash.
That's perfect. Yeah. For like a week, you're like, McCabe's the best master in the game. Fuck everyone who disagrees. Just because he made you force like 20 duels on you, you're like, this is absolute dog shit. You know, this is insane.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of a specific situation where I've fallen into that trap. Do you have anything? I guess McCabe and Pandora are that for you, right?
I think a lot going on and on about how Levy's the best.
Yeah, I don't think that's
true. My bad.
Yeah, that's fairly true.
That's just a fact.
Yeah. Well, I'm a Levy stan because I did not like him at first. I didn't see it. When the beta came out, I was like, this guy just does damage. The rest of the masters do damage as well, but they also do like tricky shit. They also add something. But after I played him enough, I was dragged kicking and screaming into him being sort of the best master in my faction. I think it's not for lack of resistance. So I guess that was a bias that I held and had to be sort of that I guess that's an example where I actually overcame the bias, because I hated his models and I didn't see the potential really. I'm just like, okay, he has, you know, good guns and like good minions. Who cares? You know, he's not doing anything extra. Eventually, I mean, just experience made me overcome it. So I guess that's, I don't know. I think that bias is pretty easy to get over. And if you're holding a bias that, is based off of some sort of like limited experience at the very beginning of the game, then obviously that's not doing anything for you. and this not this isn't related to these two biases, but this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently. It's just so we develop heuristics about the game, ways of thinking about models, ways of thinking about crews, ways of thinking about strats and schemes as a way to like cut corners and basically create cognitive shortcuts, right? So I think X Master is not good, and that's based off of, you know, this little bit of experience. And what that does for me is it, when I approach a table, when I approach a pool, whenever I approach a matchup or a problem, I can skip that part. You know, I can devote the rest of my cognitive load to thinking about other things. And that is the function of any of these ideas in terms of rating thing. And I've been thinking about that a lot, because that function, the part that it, these biases have to serve a function for me. For me to hold on to them.
Yeah.
You know what
exactly,
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So for example, I've been thinking about, so I've complained about Tara before, because I think she went from like a cool, interesting master to like a very similar master to the rest of the faction. And I've been thinking about, well, what does that bias do? Because it's obviously a bias, and it's a heuristic I've created so that I can like cut corners in figuring out GG1. It's like giving myself a boost in the arms race that is getting better at this game in the context of GG1. But what is that bias doing for me is something I've been thinking about a lot. And I think, well, other than just like cutting some things out, it wasn't doing a bunch for me. So I've been thinking a lot recently and playing against myself, trying to figure out, well, can I develop like an idea that's more useful? So like now my idea is sort of matured that there's like one specific pool in the whole packet. And if I change any scheme out of it, then she becomes worse than other masters. But I have a pool now where I think that she's at least serviceable.
That's also be a little bit, well, maybe on like opposing faction, maybe.
Well, she's she's serviceable. She's a fine master. Like if you love Tara and you want to play her, like fine, play her. But I play the whole faction, and what I'm looking for is the best master in each pool / matchup I'm going to play. So I found one where I think Tara is the best master in my faction for this one specific pool, as long as I don't get guild. And I'm fine with her living in that space now, because I was thinking about, well, what is this bias doing for me, and how can I turn it into a bias that's actually functional for me? Now, on the other end, like I have some biases about masters being in like a mid-range, you know, they're like kind of mediocre. And I think that those biases are more serviceable, because so what is the potential harm associated with rating a master better or worse than it is actually, you know what I mean? For an individual pool, for an individual matchup, the harm in rating it worse is that you're actually playing something, you actually bring something to the table that's worse. And if the harm in rating it better is sort of the same thing, that you're not, that you're actually missing something that was going to be better than what you ended up playing. So I think like saying certain masters are mediocre is like a serviceable position, where I can say, well, I know that these are good. I know this is good. Oh no, I'm in a matchup that I know is bad for these, but I don't have any biases about, you know, Zip or Von Schill or whatever, other than that they're serviceable. You know what I mean? I don't know. Do you think that's like, do you think that there's a more functional like idea other than just like they're fine, you know? What do you think?
I
were getting a little philosophical.
I try not to underrate anything, I guess, like too much being like a newer player, especially like not just things I've played, but like other masters, I guess. I try not to underrate like masters and like other factions.
Yeah, that's a good way to lose, right?
Yeah. I think it's more dangerous to underrate things than to overrate things.
Yeah.
Maybe. But, probably.
Yeah, because if you're overrating them, what's the problem is maybe you'll play too safe, right? Maybe you'll if you're playing against something and you overrate it, maybe you'll play too safe.
I think you would lose less efficiency playing like a little more safe than, you know, when you lose a key model because you were playing too aggressive because you thought your opponent's master was like garbage or something.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That's just a thing I've been thinking about that is not like, I'm not entirely sure where it's going, but I'm trying to think of a better example other than like, I think things are mediocre and that's fine. Like, what's a serviceable bias? Like,
I don't know. I can think of a specific example. Maybe something like,
because the whole point is to be like a better player whenever you're developing these like ideas, right? Yeah. So
I don't know if like assuming like, oh, this, I don't know, they'll never take whatever this master into against like my faction. I don't know if that's really a bias, because I guess there are like, that's just kind of assessing a matchup. But
I guess a serviceable bias is then to be
that,
like,
in that case, it depends where it comes from. Like if it's because, I don't know, of an experience you had, that's like recency bias though. Like,
yeah.
Sort of like if someone walk into a bad matchup because they didn't know and you crushed them, and then you assume that no one will ever play that because you think it's a bad matchup. That's kind of just the same thing.
It's like, I guess a good one would be to like, if you feel that like X model is like wholly inefficient and like maybe it's bad, if you change that to, if I run into this scenario where it's actually very good, then that is when I'm going to take it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
this is like thinking you shouldn't think this model is bad. Like if you bring a model and it performs poorly, you should just think this model didn't work in this pool.
Yeah. And like a more adaptive bias, a thing that like improves you as a player is to say, next time I'm in this pool, I'm definitely bringing this model because I know it's good here, even though it's bad everywhere else. I know it's good here.
Like any model that has, I forget the ability, the one that just no TN just pushes everything away.
Oh yeah, the one that Fahatsu, you know, that one has, right?
Yeah. What then? The Insidious Nightmares, is that what they're called? And Neverborn.
Insidious Madness.
Yeah. Those. What is that ability called? Scatter.
Scatter. Yeah.
Scatter. Like, there could be a model that's not very good, but if it has scatter, like, you know, it's good in certain pools. It's a great like claim jump model.
Okay, so the whole reason I want to have this conversation is to sort of like think about, you know, the biases that I have that are good and the ones that are bad for, you know, my performance as a player, I guess, right? One of the biases that I think people have when rating a model, and I've definitely had this at times, is what I call like 13 brain. When people rate models based off of the idea that you have like a handful of 13s. And I think that could be a way that you sort of get yourself into a pickle when you've brought like six models, all of which can use 13s really well, but are more or less inefficient outside of that. Have you found yourself falling for that trap yet?
Not really. I feel like I have 7 brain. Look at everything and think of like how they would be if I just only flipped 7s.
Dude, hell yeah. That's such a good
I look at everything like
description.
I look at every model like that. If I'm gonna flip 7s all the time, like how good is this model?
Yeah. Like especially with TNs and stuff. When I see a TN on a card, I'm like, ugh, it looks like a pile of dogs grow
like,
up to
when
me.
I have That's why I don't like lawyers, guild lawyers.
Because
for obey, you need a 9. So it's like, if you think of everything in terms of 7s, like when you see things that only need 6s and 5s, you're like, oh, that's pretty good. And then when you see things that need 8s and 9s, you're like, ugh.
I have like the opposite problem in that I assume that every TN means it's a card out of my hand. Like if I need a TN
say
more than four, I assume I'm going to have to cheat it. I assume I'm going to flip a three every single time, which is definitely a bias on my behalf and definitely like fucks me up in rating certain things. Like we were talking about Ulix the other day and I'm just like, I can't see it at all. Like, any master that has this many TNs is going to be dog TNs, shit.
Yeah.
But you're like, this shit looks good. You know, I want to play Ulix.
Yeah.
And it sounds like Oliver thinks that Ulix is pretty good now. So I don't know.
I think he's cool. I think it's kind of like thinking in the way like everything flipping a seven. It's like, oh, if I have a lawyer, like, you know, and I need a nine, half the time I have to think of how good they are as like, how good are they if I only flip a nine half the time and the other half the time I flip a five or something like that?
You know, we're talking psychology shit. So I'm just going to like take a brief little stroll into like one of my favorite personality theories. So basically, because I have like a psychology background, one of my favorite personality theories, because I sort of like identify with it more, is, you know, hedonism, right? It's basically the philosophical principle that people, you know, like the only human motivations are to seek pleasure or to avoid pain. And this like body of research just sort of argues that people dispositionally have a proclivity to do one or the other. So people have a personality that either seeks pleasure or a personality that either avoids pain. And as soon as we started talking about that in like my psych class or what, you know, like one of my undergrad classes, I was like, oh, I know exactly what I am. I'm definitely an avoid pain person. And we did like, after the test, it's like, yeah, you're pretty far on that scale. So I think that type of personality assessment definitely applies to gaming as well. In this like little convo we had is like, no, I just assume that every TN is a three. You know, I'm going to flip a three every single time because I have sort of that that personality where I just assume the worst is going to happen and my entire strategies are built on like swallowing the potential harm that could come before me. Do you think you're on the opposite where you're like a seeking pleasure type of person?
I would say not to an extreme.
Yeah.
But sometimes I push a little more towards like, oh, I'm going to make this play because if it works, you know, not to the point where it's like, I'm expecting something like impossible to happen, but like I'm going to make a play to where like, you know, if it's, even if it's a little unlikely or, you know, not like if I flip straight sevens, it's not going to work. But if it works, like the advantage I'll have is, you know, so outweighs it, I guess.
Yeah, I don't really think you fit on that spectrum super easy for me. I mean, like there are other theories of personality I could use to describe you a lot better, but so I don't know. You can be aggro, but you're very like I don't know. I don't think it comes from a position of seeking pleasure, but I do think I have a lot of strategies within gaming that are very much avoid it, very much trying to minimize harm to my crew, my strategy and stuff like that. So yeah. I just wanted to have that little aside to explain that point. Anyway, so
so one thing I always see is when is someone who in both Malifaux and Magic and every game is the bad flips, bad draws, bad rolls is like the only reason you lost, I guess, fallacy, which is pretty much never true.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the biggest things that can hinder your like growth as a player and like your improvement. Because like if you never think you did anything wrong, you're never going to like change how you play.
Definitely.
You shouldn't become that like that salty guy who gets mad because he flipped bad.
Yeah, I mean, you can't play a perfect game of Malifaux, right? I think the game is complicated enough where you're minimizing your mistakes rather than playing a perfect game. I mean, I definitely agree that that's a thing that happens, but I think there are a few ways to sort of conceptualize like reasons why you get to that point where you're like, oh, I did everything right. You know, like where do you insert sort of critical thinking about certain things? And I think often, I don't have a snazzy name for it, but people have sort of, myself included, have a tendency to exclude the first turn and how that impacted the overall assessment, because I guess this is sort of a recency bias thing, but it's even within the turns. It's like, oh man, turn three, I was up. I had killed this model, but you have all of this stuff that I can't stop. You have blah, 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 and like this, this, and this, and all this stuff that it's just like impossible to stop. And I hate to keep talking about Terra, but this was the problem. This was the actual problem with her, is that if you didn't know what you had to do, the like turns, like turn five especially, seemed uber impressive, oppressive, not impressive. Like you got to a position where I can just, Terra can just do whatever the shit she wants. And the problem with that is that you didn't correctly assess what you had to do in turn one and two, and you fucked up there. And you lost on turn five, and it looked really bad. It looked gross on five, but you really lost on turn one and two. And I think that's a pretty easy bias that translates to every matchup, in that you screwed up on turn one and you didn't really realize it until it felt helpless. You know what I mean?
That, and I guess I see, I feel like maybe when I, like, especially when I first started playing, I was like, I don't know how I lost. I did all the things to score my points, and you know, I just didn't work. I couldn't have done anything wrong. All my moves were to score my points. And then as you start playing, you realize, oh, maybe I should have, you know, put more AP towards stopping my opponent from scoring rather than just trying to, you know, just score all my points.
Really? So yeah, I think that's an uncommon problem that most new players have. I think most new players have the opposite problem, where they put all of their AP into killing and don't put anything towards scoring points. But that's definitely a thing you have to consider, right?
Like on our last, that I think it was the last game we played, where we played the last turn like five times.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, we basically, okay, if we both score 2 points, you know, if I do this, we both score 2 points. If we do this, we both score none. If we do this, we both score one. And we just like, or I score a point and stop you from scoring a point, and then you score a point and stop me. Like, and we played all the possibilities out, and it was still a draw. So kind of like every way we played it, it was a draw.
Yeah, and I think based off that, you could definitely find yourself in a position where it's like, I played hard for my points. Why, you know, how do I beat this crew now? And that was the Molly versus Titania game, right?
Yeah.
Like you played very well on turns 3 through 5, but like you just made like a couple of deployment mistakes.
Turn two, I felt like I lost the game.
Yeah.
Because Molly died, I think, on turn two.
You put like Molly on a box that she didn't need to be on top of because you were like greedy with less caress or whatever. And that was like your actual mistake. And if we could like, even though we got so like fixated on like the ending and like trying to find all of the iterative possibilities that could result in you getting a win or me getting a win, something like that. Really, it was the first turn that was where the critical analysis was needed, right?
Yeah, in the first two turns where I positioned somewhere else, and even if I had Molly for one more turn, who knows? Like, I don't know. Who knows what could happen?
Yeah, definitely.
That's what we need. We gotta, at the end of every turn, at the end of every activation, we have to take a picture of the entire board state so we can rewind
God damn it. Whatever we want. I am a loser who takes a lot of pictures so that when I'm bored at work, I can like flip through them and like, ah, I did fuck up there. I messed up there. I positioned wrong there. Exactly. I don't know. I'm a loser that way. But I think if you are also, if you think like a master's bad and you don't get why some people think it's good, or some people are winning certain matchups that you think are unwinnable, I think turn one is a good place to spend your energy, because I don't know. I've seen some things where I see people just play differently on turn one, and I'm like, oh wow, that completely opens up how the entire game flows from this state. Yeah. Like, just as an example, I was looking through some of the Vassal. So they're doing this like Vassal World Cup thing on the Weird Forums right now. And I was looking through the thread, and there was some videos that the Russians were posting of their like full Vassal games. And I flicked through one, which was Zoraida versus Terra. And it was like super interesting because the Zoraida player did something that I personally have never seen. I'm sure if you're a Zoraida player, you like know to do it, that it's like a tool in the tool belt. But like on turn one, very first activation, he obeyed the Groot Slang to go through its lair, and then obeyed through the Groot Slang at a prospector to charge Karina and with Ensorcel trigger so that he hit Mintu, killed the totem first activation, which was like a super, I was super impressed by that because it just,
that's nuts.
It's
broken. What the heck?
Yeah. It just showed so much foresight and like a confidence in the matchup to know that Karina was such an important linchpin. Without it, he's not only down an activation on turn one, but he's missing half of his Umberry mechanic. And all of Terra's demise potential and all of the healing in the crew was gone off of that four health model that he knew exactly like what to do in that position. And just like flicking through that turn, I was like, oh, wow, that's very interesting because it completely changes this matchup based off of the very first activation on turn one. And like everything else that sort of fell, you know, I was like, I didn't watch the whole like 4-hour video, but I was just going through it. It's like everything else sort of trickled down in a way that was the same as what you would expect or what I would expect playing Terra into Zoraida. But the fact that there was like a weird, not weird, I guess, if you play Zoraida, you know that that's awesome. You know, like a thing you can always do. The fact that that person did that changed the entire landscape of the game from that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's tight.
So
that's a sick move. Damn.
Yeah, it is. It made me want to play Zoraida, if I'm being honest.
I want to play Bayou.
Do you really?
Doing it. I think I do.
I'll trade you my Bayou for your Neverborn.
No, I want my Neverborn too, though.
You want everything, dude? Come on.
No, I want. We just both each have to have half the factions, and I'm claiming.
You're claiming the factions I own. Stop doing that. I could probably sell you my Bayou pretty cheap. I just bought a Hootenanny box, though. What? So I keep buying things for a Hootenanny box, which is Georgie and Olaf and the banjos and stuff.
Oh, that's tight. Yeah. Yeah. I think
so. Now cool. I have all of summer.
See, and you can play, Arcanist and whatever. And you can have Arcanists. That's your next one after Explorers. We all know that. Yeah.
Don't tempt me with a good time with Arcanist. I'll tell you what. Some dude posted some like used Sandeep crew on the trade forum today, and I was like, ooh, maybe. Instead, I just like started painting my summer shit instead, like showing a little bit of restraint.
I need to paint some stuff. I haven't painted anything in so long.
Yeah, it's hard for me to paint because I'm directly motivated by playing. So is there any other things we want to talk about bias-wise?
But I did nothing wrong fallacy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically if you lost the game, you probably did something wrong. If you won the game, you probably still did something wrong at some point.
Yeah, I think that kind of leads to – it's not really a fallacy, but I think it's a problem that people can fall into, which is to get like developer brain where – as soon as anything is a challenge, it needs to be nerfed. And if anything is like requires work, it needs to be buffed. And I don't know. It's not really a fallacy, but it's just a thing that makes you a worse player.
Not even that about the models, but it's like how you play. It's like, when I played Magic, there was this kid that I knew and I've known him a long time. And then when I first met him, I think he was probably like 16 playing Magic. He's a couple years younger than me. and yeah, he was about 16, and he would play, we would play modern format. We played like our local store tournament, and he would play Storm. If anyone's familiar, it's like a combo deck, and he, every time he would lose, he would, you know, he would say, you know, he did nothing wrong, he just didn't draw the cards he needed, and he would always have that mentality, and he would, you know, get really salty when he lost, and then eventually he grew out of it, and he just became, now he's like actually a very good player, and now he can tell you everything, he can tell you every mistake he made at the end of a game from like turn one. But yeah, he went through that where he was, you know, oh, I did everything I could have. Like, he couldn't make any mistakes. He just didn't draw the card to do the combo or whatever.
So what do you think was the growth element for him? You know, like, do you think it was talking about what he did wrong after the game? Like, you're saying he's good at now?
Yeah, probably just looking back at the game and, like, just thinking, like, you know, what did he do wrong? Did he make, you know, I guess it's, you start, it could be small, different, you know, once you start realizing mistakes and start fixing them, you know, he could have been making a bunch of mistakes. And sometimes he would say he was like, oh, I didn't, using my serum visions, I didn't, you know, take the right card or whatever. I should have kept the card or whatever. You know, I shouldn't have put that card on the bottom or whatever. And then just stuff like that. Like, you know, in Malifaux, it's like, you know, I shouldn't have made that play. I should have saved this card, you know, to cheat for this specific thing. I shouldn't have overcommit with my model. So once recognize your mistakes, it's not, the mistake wasn't that you didn't flip, you know, 13-13 on against the guy to kill him. It's that you made that play and didn't, you know, account for the consequences if it didn't work the way you wanted it to.
Yeah, was there a better play? Probably, yeah. And if so, then that's you know, you don't need to go further than
volatile
that.
Volatile play.
That reminds me of a topic I want to do for like a whole ass episode, which is to talk about coaching. And not because, I mean, like a lot of the literature on coaching basically shows that, you know, like the process of being a good coach is just sort of instilling trust. And then like the actual like growth and like learning is like, it comes from the coachee, in that like the coachee sort of like relays things to the coach, bounces off ideas. Once that there's like, you know, that sort of trust created, they're basically teaching themselves. That's kind of like what coaching is like having a trusted source to sort of teach yourself. And I think that what you're talking about there is sort of a situation where someone like got good at being a coachee, sort of like got good at finding people to sort of almost coach them in certain ways.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what happened, because he was always so stubborn, and then people, you know, all the people we played with at the local store were pretty, you know, cool with each other, and people would just, you know, if you get into that mentality, and people would just say, you know, no, you're bad. Like, you're just bad. No, you're just wrong. Like, you actually made all these mistakes. And then he became better. And then I think he just like won or got second at like a Grand Prix for Magic.
Wow. Damn, yeah. That's a groove.
And then he went to the Pro Tour.
Wow. That's awesome, dude. I mean, like, what a rags to riches sort of player story. Yeah. That's really cool. I think not only just playing, like finding a good like coach, someone you could bounce ideas off of, is super important with like any hobby growth within, you know, the tabletop hobby. Like bouncing ideas off of like better painters than you is like super important in terms of improving there. Like I used to ask Dane shit all the time. Back in the day, and he would just be like, yeah, this green looks like shit, you need like at least two more coats. You know, like stuff like that. It makes you grow like a whole lot, all that kind of stuff. All right, dude, I think that's it, man. If you don't have anything else.
That's it. No, I think that's it.
Cool. Well, if you're still listening, you should hop in the Discord. It got a lot more activity lately. We got people in there chatting quite a bit. People excited about Explore. People coming up with some some episode ideas and people asking just general advice. It's been pretty good. So hop in there if you want some chat. All right, man. You ready to go?
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Peace.
What are you doing in my swamp?
So you don't like my Swamp Fiends picture that I made?
No, man. It's yucky.
I thought it would either be like that sweaty kind of like meme good, or it would be gross. So I'm glad you're being honest.
It was gross. It was gross. It looks like they just look like it's not right. It just wasn't right. If we were broadcasting out of Central Florida.
Oh, okay.
Then maybe we'd have a little bit more of that vibe.
Okay, so I need to, let's see, what makes it Southern like, Florida then?
I don't know, but not that. That's like Lakeland or something.
Yeah, I thought that was the vibe though, dude. Fucking Florida man vibes,
That's Ocala vibes.
Well, my friend is still working on a logo. Quote, I don't know, she's moving now, so she's gotten busy, so it may never happen, but I don't know. So I was just messing around with something. What was your question?
You're from the kind of place that these restaurants would exist. Have you ever eaten at a I think it's a PDQ?
Hell yeah.
I've never. I saw one today. I've never seen one before. I've never seen one before in my life. And I saw one today.
There's one next to my old Target from when I lived in Deerfield.
Yeah, the Deerfield one. Yeah, that's a nice Target. I was there. That's where I was.
This is going to sound like a fake story, but when my parents were visiting, I used to get PDQ so much when my wife was pregnant because she liked the zucchini fries. When my parents were visiting, she's like, my mom was like, "You got any of those PDQs around here?" I'm like, "Ah, no, there's none of them." And then we went to the beach, and on the way back from the beach, I took two wrong turns, two, and we ended up magically next to the PDQ, and it was like a sign from God.
True.
It's like less shitty Chick-fil-A.
Is it really? I've never had it. Is it good? All they sell are chicken tenders.
They do sell a lot of chicken tenders. They're like
I think they have a limited menu right now. I had to do a little research online.
Their Cali Club or whatever is an all-timer. It's just like some avocado chicken sandwich. Shit's tight.
They have that right now. The menu is literally like 10 things or less.
Although I do admit that like half of my penchant for them is that they have a really good tea. Like their unsweet tea is like really good and mix a little sweet in that bitch.
Like tea?
Yeah, it's really good.
That's disgusting.